Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4. My intention was to get further than that, and I've got a few things we'll look at. But we're basically going to look at chapter 2, verse 4, and then a little bit around that. As we know, Habakkuk has asked a couple questions. He's asked God two times, and God replied the first time and says, you know, the first complaint was, why is our culture so bad? What are you going to do about it, God? God says, I'm going to raise up the Babylonians, and that's going to bring in the destruction. And then Habakkuk was taken back because why are you using the Babylonians who are ungodly? They don't even know you. They're not working for you. At least we are a culture that has knowledge of you. We're in rebellion, but we do have knowledge. You're bringing someone that has no knowledge of you. And God says, it's a legitimate complaint. He says, I'm going to, I'll tell you something. I'll reveal something to you. You better write it down. Write it down on a tablet. Make it plain. And he says the vision that he's going to give him, or again, the revelation, the information, it awaits an appointed time. There's a time in the future. It's going to be at the end. It will all come together. And now tonight, that's chapter 2, verses 2 through 3, where he says, write it down, write down the vision. Chapter 2, verses 4 through 5, that we're going to look at tonight, that is really the vision. Because it's like, this is an opinion. You don't have to agree with it, but it's, you know, you got to somehow assume, what is the vision? The vision can't be the whole book, because he says, write this down and run with it. Give it to a messenger. Remember, I showed you those little clay tablets or something small that you could run with. If it's, you know, a big monument like the Ten Commandments or something that you'd assume that you'd have to write a whole bunch of information, you could hardly run with it. So the vision itself, the message may be fairly short. And I think that we're looking at possibly verses 4 and 5 are going to be the vision. And then that's kind of summing it up. We'll look at that tonight. And then beginning in verse 6, continuing through verse 20, is going to be the five woes that are built or explain this vision. So with that being said, let's look at chapter 2, verse 2. It says, then the Lord replied, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. And so, in other words, it's guaranteed. Something is in motion. It's going to be fulfilled. It's going to happen. Just wait for the process to occur. That includes the process of working out salvation. And now we're going to read the vision. This potentially is what was to be written down and handed off and explained. And here it is. It's just two verses, potentially. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not right, but the righteous will live by his faith. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest. Because he is greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied, he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. And that would be the end of the vision, potentially. Then, beginning in verse 6, is now some details given, talking the five woes to this person, the arrogant, the puffed up one. And it says, chapter 2, verse 6, will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, and then you've got the word woe, which is the first of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 woes that are coming. And what I've just explained to you is those first four bullet points on the notes. Just exactly, I think, what I've said. If you turn to the back page of the notes, there you've got the five woes. Chapter 2, 6a introduces them, says, you know, they're going to take up a taunt. And then chapter 2, 6b, the second part of the verse, you get your first woe. And that's what you have right here on the back page. I'll just read through them. woe, number one, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own for how long and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them, meaning those who have risen up will soon be taken down because someone else is rising up. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. So you're going to begin to see it's a cycle. You do this and you have your moment in the sun. Well, someone's coming up behind you. They're going to plunder you just like you plundered someone else. And that's history. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, but the end is still to come. Number two, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. So during that time of their reign, their arrogance, the top of their game, they gain for their house to set his nest on high, meaning they're going to be here forever, to be safe from the reach of harm. Again, that's what Nineveh did. They got themselves tucked way up inside their empire. No one can get them. And that's why Nahum wrote, says, well, we're going to come get you. Babylon, no one can touch Babylon. Well, Cyrus did. And it just continues on like that. You set your nest up high so no one can reach you. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. In other words, to get this safety, you've destroyed people. You have forfeited your life in so doing. For the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. And again, some have said that refers to the fact that the very stones you built to make yourself great, you're going to be plundered and they're going to be carried off and built into someone else's fortifications. And then, for example, the Babylonian stones, or probably better yet, the stones of Nineveh, would be taken and carried over here and built into the next empire. Just one empire builds with the remains of the other empire. Number three, chapter 2, verse 12 through 14. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. In other words, that's the Hamas, the arrogance, the social injustice. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing. I mean, this is not the whole purpose that you just waste everyone's life building this. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This is not the end. This cycle is not the fulfillment of God's creation. You plundering people, killing people, using sin to advance your cause. That's not what the earth was for. Eventually, it's all going to come down on you, and the Lord is going to have his place. And he's not going to just come to plunder. He's going to fill the earth with his knowledge. He's not going to use people as slaves or use people as plunder. He's going to bring blessings so they all may rise up together. Again, now be careful. That would be the goal of all of humanity. If we have a good government, we're going to want everyone to advance and not plunder people. But understand, this is not talking about communism versus democracy. This is talking about the ways of man and the coming kingdom. You're not going to get the knowledge in the earth, as this is talking about, until the Lord establishes his kingdom. You may have better forms of government. You have better choices of government among mankind. But every one of them is got that weakness. It's going to be taken over by the proud. It's going to be taken over by the elite. And we've had a good run, but throughout our history, we've had that core that wants to take over the freedom of others. And to think that our freedoms could be taken away by a small group of elites, why would they do that? That's human nature. That's what the Assyrians did in Nineveh. That's what Nebuchadnezzar did and those that followed. That is the way of mankind. We've had a great window of time here in history, but the fact that we become corrupt, we become morally incapable of maintaining the thing, there's going to be an elite group rise up and drive us right into slavery. It's like, well, why that would never happen. It always happens. That's what history has made. You've lived in a bubble of time where you had a democracy, a republic that had a Christian influence. And as that's waned and corruption has set in, it's going to go right back to that vicious cycle. So the kingdom of God is what's going to bring about the knowledge of God. So we have right here, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as waters cover the sea. The fourth woe. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. In other words, you shame them for your own pleasure. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. You think you're in a place of power and glory because you can shame everyone else. Well, your shame is coming. You're not going to get glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. And again, that would be your lack of a covenant. You do not have a covenant with the Lord. The cup of the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. Again, that's the end result of the proud, is their shame. You're either going to be with the Lord in His glory, or you're going to be outside His glory in shame. No matter how much glory you have in this time, and that's something that the book I finished. It's the editing is done. We're now putting it all together, and hopefully send it to the printer in the next couple weeks. But the idea there is, this is one of the ideal of the promise, is nothing you have today is going to last. You've got to keep your eyes set on the goal of eternity, of the glory of God. And when you get people surrounding you that are getting the glory of this time, they're getting the attention, they're getting the press, they're getting the power. One of the things the Bible teaches is, don't let that be a distraction. It's like, well, I never get my share. Well, your share is not now. You're looking for the glory of God. You're a servant serving the kingdom that is yet to come. Again, I'm just reminded of the story, and you've heard it before, about a missionary who'd been overseas for decades, and he got on a ship, and as he was coming back, he ended up being on a ship with, I can't remember who it was, if it was soldiers coming back from the military or if it was family members coming back from overseas. And as the ship pulled up, it was a president or someone who'd gone overseas and was coming back. And as they came back, there was the place was packed. The crowd was there. There's a parade waiting. They're all waving. And they welcomed him back to his country. And as the president or the dignitary, whoever it was, left the ship and went down the street, everyone welcomed and followed. And the only one left standing was the missionary, to that effect. And, he says to God, to the effect, I've spent my whole life serving, and now I come home and there's no one here to greet me. And then the Lord says to him, son, you haven't come home yet. Meaning, you're going to serve your whole life and they never see the manifestation of, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And sometimes you don't want to hear that in this age. I mean, the last thing you want to hear from this age, this world, is, well done, thou good and faithful servant. I mean, if a church would call me and say, well done, thou good and faithful servant, it's like, where did I go wrong? Because the most institutions of this world are serving the world. It's the glory almost is in the obscurity. The glory is almost in the world doesn't recognize your service because they considered it invaluable or not valuable, because it's actually serving a kingdom that cannot be seen. So this is just like the opposite right here. The cup of the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. In other words, those who have glory today, that's not always a good sign that you're going to have glory in the kingdom to come. In fact, sometimes it is a very glaring revelation that you've got nothing coming. You got everything here. Now, that's not a guarantee. It's not a perfect fit, because you can do well here and well in eternity. But a lot of times your success here is because you're serving the masters of this age instead of the master of eternity. Then it goes on and finishes this fourth woe. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beast that terrified them, for the blood of man and the violence of the earth to the cities and all who dwell in them. In other words, the violence they did to Lebanon and the nature around is going to come back to pay them back. The last one, what profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. There it says the word woe. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his temple. Let the earth keep silence before him. In other words, the Lord is there. The earth has nothing to say. You should just be listening to the Lord. Instead of you talking all the time, the Lord is there. Be silent and listen. So those are the five woes that are coming after. We have this introduction of the vision. Write it down. And then we have the two verses of the vision that we're going to look at tonight. And then based on that vision, if this is the truth, then woe, 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 woe to the person that this is speaking about. So I think what is going to be written down on the tablet is those verses we're looking at tonight. And here is that vision. We're going to go to the notes on page one. And I've got there the in the English Standard Version with the Hebrew underneath it. The Hebrew will be useful a little bit tonight. Did you get a set of notes? I don't think there's any more left. Does anybody have an extra? I printed 8 copies. Wait. I printed 80 copies, and there's 81 people here tonight. The camera doesn't know. You can always lie to the camera. No, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, oh, 9. I got a copy. So I made 8 copies, and there's 9 people here tonight, to be brutally honest. Okay. Chapter 1, or page 1, chapter 2, verse 4. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. That's the vision that is being written down. And it's such a powerful vision that it's repeated in the New Testament, that second part, the righteous shall live by his faith, by Paul a couple times and by James, meaning that vision ran into the New Testament and it captured the essence of the New Testament message. Saying the righteous shall live by his faith. So what you've got right here, it's this individual who is puffed up or is arrogant. It says his soul is puffed up and he is not right. Not right. Something's wrong within him. His soul is not right because he is puffed up. And then you're going to have, compared to that, we'll do a little better work on this in a moment. The righteous... And the righteous in his soul is got faith. He's looking somewhere else. The puffed up one, and I want to do a better job of saying this, I'm just rushing through it. The puffed up one is arrogant and is self-sufficient. And because he's self-sufficient, he's not looking for anything. No one's self-sufficient. We are creatures. We need the Creator. But this puffed up one has a delusion that his success continues to reaffirm his false identity, his success. He keeps plundering nations. I can do whatever I want to. He becomes arrogant and something's not right in his soul. Where the righteous person is the one who realizes, or the just person realizes, I'm not self-sufficient. I need to go to God. He'll trust God. He'll be righteous and his faith is going to take him. And if you read this right here, notice right here, the righteous shall live by his faith. If you look down there in the Hebrew, and you're going to have to read it backwards, behold the proud, not is upright his soul. So behold, look, this is the truth. The proud, not right in his soul that's in him. But the just by his faith shall live. The concept here, the arrogant one, the puffed up one, his soul is not right. And he has no future. He is going to be destroyed, overthrown. He's going to perish. But the righteous, who could be puffed up, realizes his lack. He goes to God. He trusts God. And he then is going to live. So the vision basically is this right here, the puffed up person. It's not right. It's not going to last. Proverbs, pride comes before a fall. That's a real simple way of saying it. But this puffed up one, his soul is not right. The only thing he's got, he may have stuff today, but it can't last. This is not eternal. He's not self-sufficient. He's missing a relationship with the Lord who's going to give him life. And he will then perish. But the righteous one, he's going to be righteous because he's got faith. And that faith is going to cause him to live. The Lord is going to come and answer his problems. The Lord would answer this person's problems or his needs. But they're not looking. They have no needs. They're solving their own problems. They're self-sufficient. So basically, it's the self-sufficient person who is able to gain in this age, but is going to perish because eternity is not based on self-sufficiency. So I'll read this again. Behold, the soul is puffed up, or his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous, in contrast, shall live by his faith. His faith will cause him to continue to live. On page 3, the rest of the vision, top of page 3. Moreover, talking about more additional information in this vision, Wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like death. He has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects all his own as peoples. And then chapter 2, verse 6 at the bottom, that'd be the end of the vision, I think. And then chapter 2, verse 6. Now, the summary, Habakkuk's exclamation, shall not all these take up the taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up and goes through the five woes. So those two verses, verse 4 and 5, is the revelation that he, and when it talks about, well, we'll get there. Let's go back to chapter 2, verse 4, and look through the notes and see if I can explain this. One thing you may want to look at is on page 2, point 15 on page 2. That's the order in the Hebrew where it's kind of a parallel. You've got these two people. You've got the proud, like I just wrote. You've got the proud. You've got the righteous. And then the proud is identified as something's wrong in his soul. It's not right. His soul is not right in soul. Okay, he's proud. There's something wrong with his soul. The result is going to be he's going to perish. He doesn't realize in his pride, there's something wrong with his soul. So he's going to try and advance in the earth. And sure enough, in this case, it's bad. They're addressing Babylon. If it's Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, if this is written in 606, we're clearly talking about the Babylonians. If we're talking about the king of Babylon in 606, it's Nabopolassar. But Nebuchadnezzar is his general. His son is his general. And Nabopolassar is going to die right after the Battle of Carchemish, and Nebuchadnezzar, or when Egypt is driven out of Carchemish, and Nebuchadnezzar will replace him. So in 606, Nabopolassar is the king, but in a few months, Nebuchadnezzar will be the king. So it's Babylon, Nabopolassar, or Nebuchadnezzar is the he in the context of this verse. And so he, because he is proud, he goes off to try to accomplish things, and he accomplishes them and just continues to plunder. But there's something wrong in his soul that he doesn't recognize. And the result is he's going to perish, where the righteous, by his faith, he is going to trust God. Faith means trust in God. They're righteous. They're looking for an answer. Now, we're going to talk about this word righteous. That is a judicial decision. They've been made right, not because of what they did, but because their actions were then taken to court and then evaluated. There's an evaluation handed down. The righteousness in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew word, if they're righteous, is there's not necessarily this list of things you do, and if you do these things, you're righteous. These things that you do have to be evaluated by a judge. It'd be an earthly judge or the Lord himself. They're going to look back and judge what you did. The Lord's got to make that decision. And this Lord is going to look back and declare this man righteous because of his faith. He came to the Lord for help. And so this man is righteous. Remember, you're not righteous because of what you did. You're righteous because of God's declaration. Here the ideal is you're going to God saying, okay, I need help. And God says, the very fact you're here, I declare you righteous. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. You ask God, you go to Jesus Christ, and you ask for help. You ask for salvation. He doesn't give you a list. These are the things. Okay, you want to be righteous? Then let's do these things, and I'll declare you righteous. How was he declared righteous? This righteousness has to be declared. It's a judicial decision by a judge. So it's not like this guy's proud, and because he's done these things, that makes him proud. No, he is proud in his heart, and he won't look for an answer. This person has gone to God and says, okay, I'm not proud. I mean, it's a contrast. I'm not proud. I need answers. He's seeking God. And the very fact that he goes, I can't do this. I need help. Boom. You're righteous because you've trusted God, and the result, you will live. And that's the vision. That's the beginning of the vision. These guys that are destroying everyone, conquering the world, gaining glory, and they're self-sufficient, something's wrong in their soul. They have no future. This can't work. where the righteous, not because you've done something, but you've gone to God and asked for help. You've trusted God. He's declared you righteous. The future's yours. You're going to have eternity. These people are not going to even be around. They've got their moment in time. You're now hooked up with the Lord. This is absent Lord, present with the Lord. And that's the concept right there. And now Paul takes this, James takes this, and sums up the entire New Testament. And it's the same thing. The righteous will be righteous by faith. How did you become righteous? Well, it's not like you did something. And that's even undermines the concept. Well, you're trusting the fact that you trusted Jesus. And you know, they even like the Calvinists sometimes will attack someone in my position where I think people make a choice. You're either going to stay here or you're going to go to God for help. I think it's a choice. Now, a Calvinist would say God determined he made you be this way. He made you come. He won't let this person come. It's interesting because if we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar right here, we can go to the book of Daniel and actually see Nebuchadnezzar live this out in his life where he's proud. He's arrogant. This is Babylon, the great that I built, he says. You see him going to slaughter all the wise men. Just whatever he wants, he does. But through a series of events, most of the time directly connected with Daniel, it's possible that Nebuchadnezzar came down here, especially during those 7 years where he went crazy, went mad, and he made a couple declarations that the Lord was the truth. Now, again, I can't say that for sure. He may have just been making a political statement, you know, like we do all the time in our culture, our government. But there's a possibility that Nebuchadnezzar left this and came down here and had faith in Daniel's God. Going through the notes on page one, number one, behold introduces the vision. So when it says right on the tablet, and then this is the verse says, behold, that would be the beginning of the vision. If you accept the concept that verse 4 and 5 is the vision that's being recorded, the revelation. The vision, the vision recorded in chapter 2, verse 4 and 5 is the Lord's response to the issue of Habakkuk not understanding. So this right here, this is revelation to Habakkuk and to his people, and God is trying to get them to look forward and see things from behind the curtain they've never seen or understood. Here it is. The enemy is the opposition. And I just told you that 606 B.C., if that's when Habakkuk is written, it's Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, or his father, Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord explains the enemy or the opposition's soul is puffed up, not upright. So the opposition, whoever this person is, if it's Nebuchadnezzar, if it's the Babylonian culture, it's puffed up and it is not upright, which is contrary to the righteous man who lives by faith and trust in the Lord. To explain the answer to Habakkuk's confusion, the soul of the opposition is compared to the soul of the righteous. So Habakkuk can't understand this. And God says, okay, here's the revelation. You're going to have the proud and you're going to have those who have faith. The proud are going to perish. Those with faith are going to live. And then he goes on and talks more about the proud in the next verse. The word puffed up. And you can see in the Hebrew up there, it's the second word in from the right side, reading it backwards according to English. You can see the word is here. It's epela. In the Hebrew, the meaning is puffed up, bloated, tumorous, swell or swollen. And obviously it translates over as pride. It's not directly pride. It's something that is bloated. This man is bloated. And if they're bloated or puffed up, that's a good, very good image. It's not just pride. That's a character trait. Bloated or puffed up, you think of something that's hollow on the inside, that's just got this swelling shell, a tumor that's festering or something, and it there's nothing there of substance. You attack it, it just crumbles. And so that's the meaning of this word. There's nothing there except the swelling, the shell. The opposition is proud and self-exalting. The proud person's own character is a flaw that prevents any correction. This person cannot be corrected. Now, because they won't accept an answer, they don't think they've got a problem. Now, I know how this feels. I mean, I've talked about it before. I'm not sure if it's just a universal character trait, but I know I've got pride. I mean, if I'm doing something, I don't want to change. I want to continue the way I'm doing it. And I've learned from the scriptures, it's like, you probably want to check yourself, because nowhere in the Bible is your attitude that you have right now recommended. It's always condemned. So it's like, you just, maybe sometimes just out of sheer obedience, not because I'm a good person, just out of sheer, it's like, you know, it's like working out. It's like, okay, I got to check my pride. Now, I don't think I'm Nebuchadnezzar with this arrogant pride, my whole characteristic, maybe it is, but there is a lot I know in my own heart that goes right here. And once you identify it, it almost is just like this. It's easy to check because it's like, it's just a shell. It's just this self, a buffer of self-protection, and just like, be vulnerable, just let it down. And it's like, and trust God. So again, when I talk about this, it's not like, you know, I know there are people that are proud and their life is based on this. They're not going to make any corrections. But I know the danger of this, and I know the feeling of this, because when I get proud, I don't want to change. I don't want to be corrected. I don't want to admit it's wrong. I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing. I'm going to prove it will work. And you're just, and it's, if you're wrong, like in this case, you're just digging your own grave. And that's coming up here in a moment. So again, as I read this, I'm definitely talking about the enemy and the opposition, but sometimes I find myself in the enemy's camp, having the very same characteristics that the enemy has. 6C, things are not right with this person, with a person like this. The only result of a person that is in pride or puffed up is eventual disaster. They cannot sustain this. Only the Lord can sustain them, and they've rejected the Lord. And that's where you get Proverbs 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. So, I mean, it's there. It's a principle of the Bible, and you know this. Not upright, he's puffed up. His soul is not upright. And that is the word lo yashir. And yashir is the word, you can see point C, yashira or yashir, means to be smooth, to be straight, to be right. But this person is lo lashir. And you should recognize that from the book of Hosea. And I wrote that right there for you. Point A under 7. Remember, Hosea's daughter's name was Lo Rahuma, meaning no mercy, no pity, or she has not received mercy. So he named his daughter No Mercy. And, it, you know, it was mercy with lo in front of it. So it's the same idea. It's the word right with no in front of it, no righteousness or no right. The puffed up man's soul is not right. The proud man's soul is not straight. The man whose soul is swollen, not smooth. Different ways of putting that together. Page 2, the proud man has a soul that cannot be fixed or corrected by the Lord, so the man is doomed. The proud man presumes he has the answers, the strength, the resources. The success of a proud man confirms his false security and becomes a trap, a pit, and a snare for the man. He will not succeed. He may conquer the next kingdom. He may have a moment in the sun. He may plunder and build himself a palace, but it can't last. His house is built on the sand. It's almost like a formula. It's like geometry. There's just things that are truths. You can't change this. If you're proud and you succeed, it can't last. It's a shell. And again, the proud man cannot be upright because the proud man cannot be just. The proud man cannot be righteous. It's impossible to be proud and righteous at the same time. Because the only way to be righteous is to go to God for help. And the proud man can't even imagine needing help. Habakkuk's fear was that if the Lord does not intervene, the Babylonians and the nations and people like them will continue to succeed. Their success will continue to inspire them, meaning the Babylonians, they're successful here, and they good day, that encourages them to try again. They're successful again. And their pride just continues to grow with every success. They just keep getting more and more arrogant and more successful. And Habakkuk is saying, when is this going to stop? And God's answer says, it can't sustain itself forever. It's going to continue to just cycle through. They'll collapse and be conquered by somebody else, and will just continue. Their success will continue to inspire them, and there will be no stopping them. But the Lord has given Habakkuk the formula. The proud are not upright. The proud are not self-sustaining. Instead, they are self-destruction. This is a path of self-destruction. And so the first half of the verse, chapter 2, verse 4, is contrasted with the just man or the righteous man. So the first part, we already looked at that, and we compared it all. We know where this is heading. And now he switches down to the righteous man. The just man knows he needs the Lord and so begins looking for answers. So if you're proud, you're going to continue to conquer and seek success, and it's just going to affirm this and just continue to swell up as this empty, festering tumor. But the righteous man is going to be the one who realizes that he needs help, and he's going to start looking for an answer. He's going to turn to God in faith, and by turning to God, God is going to declare that action righteous. The very fact that you look for God means you're now righteous. You haven't done anything good. You haven't earned your salvation. You simply looked for help. Very much like Jesus saying, as the serpent was lifted up on the pole and the Israelites looked and the snakes, or they were healed from the snake bite, the Son of Man will be lifted up and everyone who looks to him will also be saved. So this righteousness is not, this undermines the Calvinistic attack on this. This righteousness is, as we know, it is not works. You haven't done a work to get saved. We know that. But they will say the very fact that you're placing faith in Christ is a work itself. So you have placed faith in Christ. That is a work. You had faith. And it's like that makes sense in your little Calvinistic circle. But this is just a man recognizing his inadequacy, recognizing his sinfulness, and saying, I need help, and is looking to the Lord. And he, instead of being proud and saying, I'll continue in this manner, and confirming his own self-sufficiency, he simply says, I mean, it can be as small as a mustard seed. God told Abraham, look at the stars, I'm going to make your descendants as great as large as this. And it says Abraham believed. And God said, oh, right, you're righteous. God, James says it, Paul says it, and the book of Genesis says it. God declared him righteous. What did he do? He simply believed God. He said, okay, I'll trust you. You're righteous. He didn't do anything. He was judicially declared righteous because he looked to God for help. So the proud man will continue to self-sufficiency. The righteous man is the one who hasn't done anything. It's not even like he's placing faith in Christ. What a great work you've done. You're just saying, I'm drowning here. The disciples in the boat, save us. And he saved them. I mean, if that's a work, you're just crying out to God, I can't make it. I need help. Those who, even on the day of the Lord, those who cry to the Lord on the day of the Lord will be saved. It says on the day of the Lord, if you're in that time of wrath, and God is for, those who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. It's like they just realize, oh, my gosh, everything's falling apart. And they call on the name of the Lord. You're righteous. What did they do? They did the same thing we've done. We just called to God for help. We just have, you know, surrounded this with a bunch of, again, there's nothing wrong with it, but we've got a bunch of doctrines and Protestant theology around what faith is. But basically, we recognize, help! You're righteous. God declares you're righteous. The proud man never says help. The righteous is not doing a work to become righteous. This was a proud man who simply said, help! And they became righteous. They asked, and now they're going to live. And that is the contrast. That is the beginning of the text that is being written on the tablet, is this revelation right here. Point 12 is what I've been talking about. Just or righteous is, and you see the Hebrew word there, tzaddik, and then there's an additional beginning there, meaning just and righteous. This concept of righteousness, this is 12a, this concept of righteousness is directly connected to the idea of judicial standing. The idea is a person's actions or morals is not official until it is evaluated in a legal court or by a judge. A judge declares this person's righteous. This, and that's what's happening right here. If you cry out to the Lord, you're declared righteous. Let's go to Isaiah 5:23. I'm going to read these two verses. Isaiah 5:23. And you can kind of see a reversal of this. It's the same principle, but almost presented in a reverse way. Isaiah 5:23. And here you've got a list of woes starting in chapter 5, verse 8. You got a woe to you who add house to house. I'm in Isaiah chapter 5. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 woes here. Isaiah is speaking. The first woe is, woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. In other words, you see buying up everybody's property. That's the elite buying out everybody's property. And they just, all, where did those people all go? They just went driven into poverty. Verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks and who stay up late at night. They're inflamed with wine. In other words, they're living the life of luxury. They've got so much that they get up in the morning and all that, just, you know, rock and roll all night and party every day type of living. Verse 18, woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes and who say, let God hurry, let him hasten his work so we may see it. Let it approach. In other words, they just keep pushing sin, saying God's not going to do anything about this. In other words, they're mocking God. They're mocking the Christians, the believers who say there's the standard of righteousness. And they just keep pushing. How far can we go? You take this sin that was here, if it was sexual sin in the 60s, and then, you know, then in the 70s it got pushed, then you got the homosexuality coming out of the 70s and 80s, that got pushed, you keep getting pushed further and further now into transgender and gender identity. You just see, how far are you going to push this? You had the sexual revolution in the 60s, and now here we are. It's like, that's what's taking place there. Verse 20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. See, the very fact that I challenged or mentioned gender identity, that's evil because you shouldn't do that. You're not being tolerant. It's like, okay, well, who's wrong now? It's like they pushed the sin so far, and if you identify it as sin, now you're evil for pointing out the sin. I mean, that's where Isaiah lived. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. I mean, that's another way of saying proud and haughty. Whoa. I mean, you're on the path. You're clever. You're wise in your own eyes. But actually, Romans says you become a fool. Thinking to be wise, you become more of a fool, and you're on the path to destruction. Woe to you. Verse 22, and this is what this verse we're looking at is coming here. Verse 23 is what we're looking for. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe, but deny justice to the innocent. And there's that ideal of justice. They acquit the guilty. They're guilty, but they declare the guilty innocent. But the just, they are just, and they're waiting to be declared, their actions declared just, but they deny them justice. They won't call them. In other words, God is saying, if you reach out for me, I'll declare you righteous. I'll declare you just. These people are doing just the opposite. They're waiting for they've gone to court to be declared just. And instead, how do you get declared just? You've got to give them some money to be declared just. And those who are actually just are denied. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and dry grass sinks down in the flames, so their roots will decay. In other words, there's only thing that can happen is judgment. I'll go to Job 13, please. Job 13. And Job is going to want to be declared righteous. That's a lot what the book, I mean, see, it's a long book, but basically Job doesn't understand why all these bad things have happened to him. And we do, because God says he was righteous, he's upright, and told Satan that Job's not going to turn away from the faith. Even though he doesn't get anything in life, he loses things, he's going to continue in his faith. Well, Job has been advised by his friends, which appear to be three theological students from seminary, or, you know, you can joke about that all you want. But they come and they give him advice, and they say, well, no, we've got all the doctrines here. Bad things don't happen to good people, basically, is what they're saying. But they take a lot of turns talking about it. And Job is saying, I want to present my case because I know my own heart. And in chapter 13, verse 18, I'll begin. Oh, man, here's a great verse. Chapter 13, verse 15, maybe the greatest verse in Job, maybe the greatest verse of faith in the Bible. Though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. Now wrap that. There's your hope right there. I'm going to trust God. If it means he's going to slay me in this life, I will still put my hope in God. If hoping in God leads to my being killed, being slain, I'm still going to stay with God. Though he slay me, yet I will. That's one of the verses when I was teaching this in Tulsa. That's one of the verses that caused me to that was the final one that I unhitched the cart to the Word of Faith movement. I going through Job and it's like, wait, this isn't me. It'd been presented in a summary. I don't want to waste time on this. But I'd asked about the book of Job down in Tulsa in the 80s. And the answer was, well, if you read right here, Job says there they found the verse. How you can always find. Remember how last night we went and tried to, we looked and we found out of Pseudo-Ephraim writing in 600 B.C., there's this little bit of a verse, and that's the rapture verse. But when you step back and put it in context, it's not a pre-trib rapture verse. It was completely the opposite. Well, there's a verse in Job that says, that where Job says, my greatest fear has come upon me. Boom, that's all the Word of Faith charismatics needed. Because Job had a fear. He feared these things, and God couldn't protect him. And it came down on Job because he feared. You got to have faith. In fact, you got to buy my cassette tapes right here. I'll tell you how to have greater faith. It's called, brain delusion. Delude yourself and don't fear. Have confidence. Don't face reality. Live in a fantasy world. And you too will get the blessings of God. Basically, that was the message. And that's basically the message I bought when I was 25. It's like, that's great. I'll do it. I'll join the cult. And then I started studying Job. And I asked, what was going on there? They said, well, Job had a fear. And his greatest fear came upon him. If you've got fear, you don't have faith. If you don't have faith, bad things happen. Okay, I don't want to have fear. So then you just keep, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not going to die. I'm not going to get sick. Just think positive thoughts. Not that's positive reinforcement. And there's a truth to thinking positive thoughts, but it's not biblical faith. Because you read the book of Job, the book begins, the author of the book begins, there was a righteous man who was blameless and upright and feared God, shunned evil. In other words, we start the book, Job is basically perfect. And then the angels came and Satan came with them, and God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Same lines. He's blameless. He's perfect. He's upright. He shuns evil. He fears me. He says, there's no one like Job on the earth. He says, Job is not bending his knee to your system. And then, of course, Satan says, he says, you just protect him. You just give him all these good things. He says, he'll take all his good things from him. He'll still worship me. And he comes back at the next conference meeting a few months later. And God says, how's Job doing? He says, you wouldn't let me strike his flesh. If I strike his flesh, he'll curse you to your face. God says, okay, go ahead, but don't kill the man. So Job gets boils and all these problems, and now he's got no possessions. He's lost all his money. His family's dead. Now he's all broken out. His body's being struck. And Satan comes back again. God says, have you considered my servant Job? It's like he's still upright. He has not turned away from me. And now we go to Job. With that being said, now we know what happened, and he's sitting on this pile of ashes. He's like, what's wrong? And his theology is all, just like Hosea or Habakkuk, was his theology had this system of theology. It got rocked because God's going to destroy Israel or Judah with the Babylonians. Like, whoa, that doesn't make sense. Well, Job is doing all these things trying to live right before God. Now, this is before Israel. This is probably around 2000 B.C. because Job's age matches Abraham's age. And there's no mention of the Levitical priesthood, no mention of Israel, no mention of the chosen people, nothing. There's not even any intention, idea of Israel being God's chosen people. It's probably before or at the time Abraham was called. I would put, again, this is me just speculating, Abraham, Melchizedek, Job, all in the same as contemporaries as he'd be like one of the Melchizedek priest type guy that you have there. Nonetheless, Job then, while he's sitting on the ash heap and his friends come, he wants the chance to go to God, and he's mad at God. He says, I've done my part. I want to see God in court. I want to be declared righteous. He says, I'm blameless, I am upright, I fear God, and I shun evil. So the author describes Job that way. God describes Job that way to Satan. And when it all falls apart, Job describes himself the same way. So you've got three testimonies. Job's character and behavior is not the problem here. The problem is this angelic warfare, and it turns into, that's all taken care of, but what ends up being the problem is Job can't wrap his mind around this angelic warfare, that he's a pawn in this game, and he's got to trust God. And so here he's arguing right here. He says in verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this will turn out for my deliverance, for no godless man would dare come before him. And I'm in Job to verse 23. That's where I'm setting. Where am I at? Oh, at 13, verse 18. Okay. He's saying, I'm going to go to God. My hope is in God. If I'm going to get justice, it's going to be before God. And if I go to God and he slays me, I'm still going to go to God. That's the only way I'm going to get a fair deal out of this. He says, the very fact I'm going to go to God for an answer would indicate my innocence, because no guilty, godless man would go to God and say, I want you to make a fair decision. He says, the very fact I'm going to go to him and I'm being bold is a clear, and he's arguing with his friends, is a clear indication I consider myself innocent. Listen carefully to my words. Let your ears take in what I say. Now that I have prepared my case, I know I will be vindicated. In other words, I'm all prepared. I'm going to go to verse 22. Then summon me and I will answer. Oh, I rushed through it. He said, I prepared my case in verse 18. Verse 19. Can anyone bring charges against me? If so, I will be silent and die. If you can find what I've done that deserved this catastrophe, show it to me and I'll go, you're right. I'll be quiet. You win the case, and I'll just go ahead and fade away. I'll die. Only grant me these two things, O God, and then I will not hide from you. Withdraw your hand far from me and stop frightening me with your terrors. In other words, stop punishing me and stop intimidating with your glory, so I can come to you face to face like a man and argue my case like I argue cases in court. Because if you read early in the book, Job was some kind of a lawyer or attorney who would argue in the courts for the widow and the orphan. He would go out and he'd go and defend them in the courts. And then all these things came upon him, and he was a defender of the orphans. And so now he wants to do the same thing. He wants to go to God face to face and have a debate. But first of all, God's punishing him and will crush him on the way. Plus, God's glory will terrify him. So just tune those things down and I'll make a case for myself. Then summon me and I will answer. Or let me speak and you reply. You ask me to come and I'll defend my case. Or if you want to go first, you'll speak and I'll defend my case before you. How many wrongs and sins have I committed? Show me my offense and my sin. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? He's asking for a court case there in chapter 13. Yeah, right there. Okay, now go to chapter 40, verse 8. I got to keep moving here. Chapter 40, verse 8. The book of Job, we should take time and go through it. It's just there's so much. I mean, I've taught it before verse by verse twice, not in West Des Moines. But you've really got to kind of get set, because it's like, I don't want to say reading Shakespeare. I've never read Shakespeare. But I mean, you just got all this flowery language. It's like if you don't pay attention, it's just like, and you could say like, I want to defend myself before God. Okay, you said it. But Job will say it like in two chapters. You know, and just like, what? And it'd be boring because I keep saying the same thing over again. He keeps using illustrations. Okay, now we're in chapter 40, verse 8. And, okay, here's, I'll chop chapter 40, verse 1. Job's been asking, I want to stand before God and be declared righteous. Chapter 40, verse 1. The Lord said to Job, now here's the kicker. He's never comes to Job and says, here's what's going on, Job. Satan and I are having this debate. Satan and I are I'm trying to prove my point. He never says that to Job. He just comes down and challenges Job. And the basic answer is, Job, do you trust me or not? And Job says, I do. And God begins to ask him a bunch of questions he can't answer. He says, you don't even have the ability to understand how to ask me a question. Do you trust me or not? And basically, I do. And that ends the case. It's like, just keep trusting the Lord because he knows what he's doing. But chapter 40, the Lord comes to Job. I hope you enjoy this way off subject. Chapter 40, verse 1. The Lord said to Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer. Then Job answered the Lord. He's been whining for 39 chapters. I want my chance in court with God. And God finally shows up and says, okay, you want to speak to me? Let's hear it. Job says, here's his chance. I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? Can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low, and look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them in the dust together. And it goes through all these things. And Job's like, yeah, I can't do any of that. And so basically it's like, Job, I know what I'm doing. And Job just, you know, like he said, I cover my mouth. And let's go to chapter 42 to end this. Chapter 42, verse 1. Then Job replied to the Lord, and the Lord gives him two chapters of just unstopping, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you do that? Chapter 42. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel with knowledge? You have asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? In other words, who's come into my court railing about some court case and you have no knowledge of anything? Surely, he says, I spoke of things I did not understand. I'm sorry I came to court today because I do not fully understand the law. Surely I spoke of things I do not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. I mean, he's basically in God's presence, and God says, speak. And he says, I'm even too ashamed to admit that I'm here. I don't even want to be here anymore. Whatever you want to do, I will. It's fine with me. And, of course, that's, again, a great, I don't want to say a story, because I think it's an actual historical account. I would suggest Moses wrote this while he was in the land of Midian, or at least got the story in the land of Midian. No one knows for sure. But when it comes from the land of Midian in that area. And while he was there as a shepherd, he may have heard of it. He may have recorded it. But I would guess Moses wrote Job. It's written in the ancient style. It may be the first book of the Bible written. Now, again, I think there's documents in the book of Genesis that go back to Noah's time and even before, where they've collected documents and Moses edited them together in their actual documents, edited together to form the book of Genesis. But that would have been done in the wilderness between 1445, 1400 BC. Job may have been written before that by Moses. So it may have been the first book recorded. And the language kind of defends it. It's an ancient book. And nonetheless, it's interesting if it is, it's an early book, but whatever it is, it's amazing that that kind of a topic has come up and that is so clear. And that is what the prophets are struggling with. Even Habakkuk is struggling with this right now. I'll finish this right here. Point 15, we've looked at it already on page 2. The order of the Hebrew wording in this verse is just like this. You've got the proud compared to the righteous. The proud, they are not upright in his soul. There's something wrong with their soul. But the righteous in their soul is a cry for help, is faith. They trust God. And the proud then is, that's what's in him. Nothing. He's going to perish. But because the righteous, they've cried out to God for help. They've cried for faith. They're trusting God. They shall live. So you've got the proud. Their soul's messed up. nothing inside of them. They're going to die. The righteous, they've gone to God. They're going to live. And that is the beginning of the vision. And we'll pick up next week with chapter 2, verse 5. It goes, moreover, for the proud, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. Meaning he's got to continue to prove his point. He's got to continue to prove he's self-sufficient. He is greedy. His greed is as wide as Sheol. We'll talk about that. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects all of his own people. And continues there. And we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon in context. But this, of course, would extend to all the empires and ultimately to Satan himself. I mean, this is the nature, the character of Satan who fell because of pride. I'll pray and we'll be finished. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We do ask that we would recognize the pride in our own heart and humble ourselves, that we would come to you continually to seek you for help and guidance, that our trust would be in you. We do thank you for revealing these things to us and ask that we would take advantage of the truth that you've shown to us. We do ask that we would mature and grow and be productive in this life, but especially be strengthened at this time to stand in faith in the face of opposition. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being here.